Welcome to Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics with your hosts, Peter Leggi
and Peter Lim.
We are podcasting from the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing, and this is our first anniversary episode.
Yes, indeed.
Incredible. We've made it this far, Peter.
Yeah. And it's a rather auspicious day to be doing it.
Yes, it is. Today is President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration. And in honor of the inauguration, the MSU Library, thanks to Peter's efforts, has put on an Obama and Africa exhibit, which is on the fourth floor of the MSU Library in East Lansing in the West Wing. And it includes an Obama Kanga, that's a women's dress or wrap from East Africa, some t-shirts, key rings, buttons, badges, bumper stickers, caps from Kenya. There's some great photos of Barack Obama with our friend Ahmed Katrada on Robben Island in South Africa. And my personal favorite is the Kenyan beer bottle with the local beer that used to be called Senator, but was renamed in Barack Obama's honor, President. So check it out. It's on the fourth floor of the MSU library. There was at Northwestern University last November also a similar exhibit. So keep that in mind as well.
And there's an interesting story to that bottle of President beer. When the parcel arrived from Nairobi, courtesy of the Library of Congress, Nairobi office, the parcel was quite damp when the mail assistant brought it to me. And there is a theory that the stubby of beer was actually full when it left Nairobi, but we may never know.
I like that, Peter. Well, hopefully we'll be able to drink some of that President beer sometime soon together in Nairobi with our Kenyan friends.
Yes.
And it is really an incredible day today, and I'm reminded of the words of the black intellectual Cornel West, which he shared with Amy Goodman on the program Democracy Now! In mid-November, soon after the election. And this is what Cornel West had to say about Obama's election. And I quote, "This has been a political ice age, and the melting is just beginning. And Barack Obama is a symbol, but we've got to move from symbol to substance. We've got to move from what he represents in a broad sense. And it's a beautiful thing to have a black man in the White House, we know that. And black slaves and laborers and other white immigrants built the White House. And to have a black family there, significant. Black face for the American Empire, fine. Can we revitalize democratic possibilities on the ground with Barack in the White House? I think we can. We can put some serious pressure on him, and we can actually continue the democratic awakening among working people and poor people and push Barack in a progressive direction." End quote. From Cornel West on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman.
And there happens to be a very interesting conference this week at Syracuse University, organized by Horace Campbell, on Barack Obama and Africa, Which Way? A conference at which there'll be two speakers from Michigan State, David Wiley and myself. So that will be an interesting gathering.
Very interesting.
Well, our special guest today is Martin Klein, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Toronto, a leading scholar of slavery, especially in West Africa, and a major player in African history for several decades. In Toronto, he mentored many doctoral students, including from a variety of African countries. Martin Klein has written widely on West Africa and slavery, notably in Senegal, Guinea, and Mali. Has also written on African peasants, workers, Islam, and colonial administration. In 1968, his book Islam and Imperialism in Senegal was published, and more recently, in 1998, Cambridge University Press released his penetrating work entitled Slavery and Colonial Rule in French West Africa. Professor Klein has edited several influential collections, including Peasants in Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, back in 1980, and Breaking the Chains, Slavery, Bondage and Emancipation in Modern Africa in Asia in 1993. He also co-edited Perspectives on the African Past with Wesley Johnson and two other very influential collections, Women and Slavery in Africa with Claire Robertson in 1983 and Slavery and Colonial Rule in Africa with Suzanne Myers in 1998. Since his retirement from University of Toronto, Marty Klein has continued his work on slavery in Africa and from a comparative perspective. In 2002, he published the Historical Dictionary of Slavery and Abolition, and today he is the editor of the wonderful new series from Cambridge University Press, New Approaches to African History, a series of short books oriented to undergraduate needs. Professor Klein has been a powerhouse in the Canadian Association for African Studies and also across the border in meetings of the African Studies Association. In November at ASA in Chicago, he took part in a particularly penetrating panel, Rethinking Slavery in Africa, called Knowledge of Africa, Slavery and Emancipation in West Africa, with Kristen Mann, Philip Misevich, James Searing and Gareth Austin. Professor Klein spoke very eloquently, giving a broad historiographical sweep of slavery and its study in a presentation entitled From Periphery to Center, The Question of Slavery in African Historical Analysis. It was there that I interviewed him for Africa Past and Present. Hello, I'm Peter Lim, and we're at the African Studies Association conference in Chicago, or as some people here are saying, Obama City, and I'd like to very much welcome Emeritus Professor Martin Klein of the University of Toronto. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be with you, Peter.
Perhaps, Martin, we could start with a little background about how you got involved in Africa and researching Africa and perhaps your first visits to Africa.
Well, I originally started out in German history, but I was somewhat bored with what I was doing in graduate school, and I realized that I became quite fascinated with the problem of the impact of Europe on colonized societies. And there wasn't much on Africa, so I decided to take a look at Africa. And once I got to Africa, in fact, once I got involved with Africa, I was hooked. And two things happened early in my career. One is that I enjoyed teaching. The first time I taught, I realized I loved being in a classroom. And the second is I got into an archives, and then I got into doing oral interviewing, and I liked what I was doing. I liked the task of sitting down, pulling things together, and trying to figure out what it all means. Being a historian is being a detective in a way, is trying to put the pieces together in a puzzle. And once I started to do it, that was it. And I will add that Africa, from the day I arrived in Senegal, I enjoyed the place. People received me warmly. Within a couple of months, I had a family, a polygamous family, that invited me to stay at their place in the middle of the region I was studying. And the father was, in some sense, my father in Senegal, and his sons were my guides, my friends. Much of what I learned was learned either bumping around on washboard roads looking for old men, or sitting under the stars drinking what the Senegalese call Arab tea and talking about the big questions in life. And it hooks you, and I've been doing it all my life.
And I remember at your presentation here at ASA, you referred to sitting under the stars, and you were actually talking about the study of slavery in Africa. And that of course, was one of your major research areas. But I understand you also traveled to Congo in the early years.
I had a Fulbright from... I wasn't sure I was going to stay in Senegal. And I wanted to get to Africa while my kids were young. And when I wrote a former student of mine in the Congo, he said the Americans were trying to fund a professor at Levanium University. And I spent a year there.
Mm. And eventually you finished at the University of Toronto. What took you there?
Well, it was a good job. I spent 5 years in Berkeley, my first job, my first post-PhD job. And then I arrived in Toronto in 1970. And I also like living in Germany. I've been very lucky. I've spent my career in places I enjoy, both big cities and dusty villages. And we clicked in Toronto. Toronto is also open for the establishment of a program. There were good people in political science. The program was created by Cranford Pratt, who had been the first principal of the University of Dar es Salaam, at a time when Dar es Salaam was intellectually the most exciting place in Africa. Mm. And he was trying to do some of the same thing in Toronto. And he brought together a really good group of people. The historians weren't totally convinced. When he got money for a history appointment, they wouldn't commit themselves to keeping anybody. And I wouldn't go for 1 year, so they took me for 2 years. And then when I got another offer, I asked them that they want, were they going to make me permanent or not? And they said yes. But the history department was skeptical, but they let me do what I wanted to do. And I had interesting students, and the whole African scene in Canada was much more limited than in the U.S., that African history in particular was not taught everywhere. In fact, it was taught in very few places. But we had a very good group of people, and we had interested students. Canada was getting more and more involved in the larger world, and people were interested in going. I had students who wanted to travel in Africa. I had students who wanted to work, do development work in Africa. And my students were always a mixture of group of people. We had in Toronto an increasingly large a black community, largely of Caribbean origin. But they were always outnumbered by the white kids and by East Asian kids who were interested in development, were involved in African culture. I had one guy who started by getting hooked on reggae, and then he wanted to understand Caribbean society, and Caribbean society wanted to understand the African roots. So these kids were always fun to teach.
Well, we're here at the African Studies Association of the United States, but that also raises the question of the study of Africa across the border in Canada, as you were just starting to elaborate, and there's the Canadian Association of African Studies and its journal, and you have been very prominent in that area. Could you talk a little bit about African studies in Canada historically and today? How are trends?
Well, there were two things. Two things that were missing in Canada. The impulse to the development of African studies in Europe was the experience of the colonial rule, and Canada never had colonies. The other thing is we didn't have a huge black population insisting that we study their origins, mm-hmm. as had happened in the U.S. in the late 60s. On the other hand, Canada was becoming more internationally conscious, particularly during the Trudeau years, and Canadians were traveling more abroad. There was a tradition of missionary work. There were Canadians who'd been to Africa in the service of the British Empire, and there were quite a few Canadians who, while doing graduate work in Britain, had taken contracts to teach in Africa. And the core of our African program at Toronto, and also at the neighboring University of York in the city of Toronto, was people who had taught in Nairobi or Dar es Salaam. And so we had a lot of people who had who had hands-on experience of Africa. And as I suggested earlier, we had a good student response. We always had students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level, who were fascinated by our teaching. And with time, one of the things that's happened now, partly because there's a new generation that has taken over, is that university after university now is starting to add. And they're doing things in the beginning of the 21st century that American that happened in the United States 20, 30 years earlier. But the teaching, I think some of it is that there's been a change in the attitude toward African history. That when I started, one of my senior colleagues asked me, didn't I belong in the anthropology department? And I said, no, I'm a historian. And what's happening now is that we have a lot of non-Africanists who've done a course on African history. Mm. And they've had African friends, and they've had friends who teach African history or study African history. So that there is an acceptance that the history of Africa is part of the history of humankind in the world, and that there are interesting and important chapters. That Canadian universities are getting more internationally oriented. And I think what's happening, and it's happening partly through the retirement of my generation, is quite exciting because younger people are bringing in a broader conception of what historians are studying, should study, the questions we're asking. And the regeneration of my own department, which is purely a result of a whole generation retiring, has really been quite exciting.
Well, last night at the Abiola lecture, the distinguished Kenyan historian Bethwell Ogot also referred to this earlier generational resistance within the historical profession to the study of Africa, and he cited Hegel and Hugh Trevor Roper, and then proceeded to demolish them. And that raises this whole question of historiographical developments more broadly. And so maybe we could also continue the conversation with regard to your own very extensive researches, one of which has been slavery in West Africa and slavery more broadly speaking. And at the conference here, you gave a splendid survey of the historiography of slavery in Africa and actually how recent this trend is. So maybe you could elaborate a little bit about this and maybe bring in some of your more recent research. And you have been looking at African sources of the slave trade and the relevance or the connections in this history. So,
well, let me start in general terms. When I first got to Africa, the published work, which then was quite limited, tended not to focus a lot on slavery and slave trade within Africa. There was an interest in the 19th century, but mostly because, particularly for African scholars, it was a period when Africans, when you could study Africans, when Africans were kings and they were shapers of history. The colonial regimes had used slavery the horrors of the African slave trade to justify colonial conquest. But then once they were in power, they were frequently allied to slave-owning elites. Colonial rule was very thin, and partly because European parliaments were not willing to subsidize colonies, and partly as a result, Africa was, as Sarah Berry calls it, hegemony on a shoestring, and it meant they relied very heavily on African intermediaries, African chiefs, African clerks, African soldiers, and many of these people were slave owners. And so they abolished slavery, they effectively abolished the slave trade, and that was very important. It meant that when people visited Africa, they didn't see chained people being dragged from place to place in chains. But it also meant that that there was a tendency to push slavery into the corner and to ignore the fact that there was a heritage of slavery, that the experience of the slave trade had been very traumatic for Africa. And the nationalists were not particularly interested in changing this. To the degree that the nationalists talked about slavery, it was that colonialism was a form of slavery of all Africans, of all social classes. And there was a small number of us in the late 60s and early 70s who, in various ways, were confronted with slavery. We confronted it in the archives. We were confronted by events. I mean, just like, for example, one of the things I described in my thesis, which was not about slavery, was a case in which a Senegalese soldier sold the woman he had been given as the result of a victory. And it's my first confrontation with something I'd never seen in the books, and that Africa was conquered by an African army of men who were not well paid but were well rewarded with booty, and the most important kind of booty was female slaves, and sometimes they sold their slaves they were given. They also depended on their women to cultivate food for them, and it was the whole system was based on slavery, and we began to confront slavery in other ways. Our friends would talk about people who had slaves, and so gradually, some of us, somewhat hesitantly in my case, started doing research on slavery. Much of this research was often peripheral to major questions, so that if you look at the two important books, collections that come out in the 70s, one from France, edited by Claude Mayassou, and one from the United States, edited by Suzanne Myers and Igor Kapitov, most of the authors never wrote a book about slavery. But when Myers, Kapitov, and Mayassou said to their friends, "Do you have data on slavery?" They were all, you know, all the people who ended up contributing said yes. And some of the articles were very interesting. So that there's an increasing awareness. And as people start publishing, more and more people go to the field recognizing the importance of slavery. And so there's more and more research which is being done on slavery. Questions people dealing with the 19th century are forced to recognize that anybody dealing with the earlier period, obviously the period of the slave trade, is confronted by the fact that the slave trade dominates Africa's relationships to the world, but also that much of Africa lived for 400 years in constant fear. I mean, I have often thought about what happens when a kid is kidnapped. Hmm. When a kid is kidnapped in any community in North America, women start walking their children to school, people start being nervous about letting their kids play alone in the street. I mean, the anxiety from a single kidnapping is very striking. Mm. And what we recognize increasingly as we start to study this stuff is that the workings of the slave trade created a constant anxiety in large parts, and the areas of Africa that were involved went further and further.
And you mentioned the 19th century, and at your very interesting panel, there was evidence of a new generation of historians of slavery. Kristen Mann was talking about the recovery of the lives of individual slaves. And she had mapped from court records and other archives and oral traditions the stories of some of these individual cases. And that's starting to come out also in southern Africa with the work of Nigel Warden on court records. And but what about the further development of this research into slavery? You mentioned these seminal volumes of the 70s. How did it then develop in the 80s and 90s?
Well, we got into more and more questions. I mean, just a small thing. Claire Roberts in the early 80s approached me because she had done interviews with a woman who eventually acknowledged that she had been a slave. And Claire didn't know how to interpret this because the woman didn't seem to be under the control. She was an old woman, but there was little sense of her being, she wasn't a plantation laborer. And we talked about her interviews, and then she said to me, why don't we publish, why don't we do a book about women? And I actually, I agreed to it, and I at one point I was about ready to pull out, because I had so many other things I was doing. But as I got into it, I realized just the simplest phenomenon, the simplest thing, and that's that most African slaves were women. And I began to look at statistics that we had. I began to look at narratives. I began to look at the data I had and the research I was doing in Senegal. And it was clear that the slaves who were kept in Africa, the majority of women who were traded in Africa were kept within Africa, and largely because Africans preferred women. And the second largest group was children. Their children may have been as numerous as women. Their children ceased to be children very quickly. And that totally changes your perspective on Africa, and I think we've influenced a lot of people, and others have followed up on it. One of the problems with the slave research is the slaves are often anonymous, and that's one of the things Kristen was reacting to, and in fact many of us have reacted to, that much of our data on slave trade comes from Europeans. Comes from, on both slavery and the slave trade, mm-hmm. and you've got to differentiate between the two. Administrators, slave traders themselves, missionaries, we're heavily dependent on Europeans, and much of the most interesting research done in the 70s and 80s, and in fact all the way through, it is statistical. I mean, the most awesome research done on the slave trade, on the export trade, is the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, which now has data on 35,000 voyages. And when you consider that scholars estimate there are about 41,000 voyages in all.
And there's now an accessible database online.
And there's a database, and in fact you can use that database. I've used that database to build my argument for the predominance of women in the trade. But the database doesn't give you names. It gives you anonymous bodies, anonymous people.
Ship lists and things like that.
You're dealing with ships. With ship lists. And they will tell you how many women, how many children. They will tell you what the mortality rate is. We have awesome data, but what we wanted to do was to get personal data. And there have been a number of remarkable contributions. The most interesting is a book on witchcraft by Rosalind Shaw, who sees in witchcraft belief the fear of slavers. I mean, her witches are people who ambush people, who take them off to a witch city, who put them to work in the witch city producing things. You can take the area she worked in, which is the Temne of Sierra Leone, and look at Portuguese descriptions of of religious beliefs in the 17th, 16th, and 17th century, and look at witchcraft belief, even as it exists today, and it really reflects all the fears and anxieties that the slave trade causes. That also is a remarkable book by Marcia Wright called Strategies of Slaves and Women, in which she takes a series of narratives that came out of, that were collected by German missionaries in East Africa. And she gives us human beings and the struggle of human beings almost totally powerless to have some control over their own lives. And we're building on that. I'm involved right now. I'm involved in several things, but one of the things I'm involved with is a project to collect African sources for the slave trade. And it's a collaboration between myself, Sandra Green from Cornell, Carolyn Brown from Rutgers, Kofi Anyadoho from Ghana, Alicia Belagamba from Milan, and Ibrahim Etiouf from Senegal. And we had a conference last year in Bellagio, Italy, and we had so much interest we decided to do a follow-up conference. I pushed it. The original idea was Sandra's, but the Toronto conference was my idea. And we're looking at a whole series of different types of sources. We're looking at court cases, prosecutions within Africa, in which people who, in which slaves are often giving testimony. We're trying to collect from missionary archives and missionary publications biographies. Missionaries often wrote this down because they're talking about their converts and why their converts come to them. But in doing so, they often capture the lives of people. And these people have names and they have faces and they talk about their fears and their failures and what they regret. And so you have a human face on the process. We're talking about proverbs. Mm. You know, proverbs don't have a human face, but they tell you what some of the values of societies are. We have people who are looking at music and dance. We had a paper at Bellagio on dirges and in the Cameroon. And dirges are a case where people talk about other things than the deceased. And some of the dirges sung by slaves are really rather plaintive. And they capture some of the dilemma of the slave condition within Africa, where we're not all slaves, where most slaves did not do plantation labor of the kind they did in Jamaica or Georgia or Brazil or Cuba. And we have a correspondence. There's been a recent recovery of Arabic documents in the Southern Sahara. And we have two young scholars, one an American, one an Algerian, who have translated a set of 10 letters between a trader who is a slave and the family who owns him, but whom he represents. And it's a kind of slavery which is beyond the imagination of most Americans, because it's not a guy who's covered with sweat, who's picking cotton or who's chopping sugar cane. It's a guy who's in business.
It's this more benign feature of a lot of African slave systems.
African slave systems can be abusive. The treatment of slaves, for example, in contemporary Mauritania has provoked, I hope, the end of slavery there. And masters can be quite cruel. And the problem of slavery is that people are owned, and masters can have absolute control over them. But it's what masters have an interest in doing. And one of the things about not only Africa, but also Asian forms of slavery, is that slaves in many societies are part of the elite. Hmm. That is, they're in elite families, and elite families will often will use their slaves in ways that almost require them to treat them well. If you're going to send somebody to trade for you, you don't want him to disappear. Hmm. You're going to give him merchandise, you want him to come back. Hmm. So you want him to have an interest. Hmm. But African kingdoms, for example, had slave soldiers, slave messengers, slave generals, slave chiefs. And in the same way, merchant families, if your son was not very bright, but you had a slave who was a very good trader, the slave might start out as a porter, carrying goods on his head. You might find if you had a military challenge, you had to depend on your slaves to defend you. But then as he proves himself, he may prove himself to be a lot brighter than your son. Mm. So you're not going to send your son who's not very bright, you're not going to give him goods to go on a trading expedition. The slave knows that he's totally dependent on you. His well-being depends on his being loyal to his master. And so a significant number of slaves in Africa operate in these elite roles.
Right.
Of course, in other areas, you have large numbers of slaves who are doing agricultural labor. One of the things about the 19th century is that when the Atlantic slave trade ended, there was an increasing demand from Europe for commodities like palm oil, peanut oil. Europeans wanted cotton, though they didn't always get it, but cotton they wanted.
Yeah.
And so slaves within Africa were thrust into agricultural labor. The agricultural labor was often organized in ways different from the American plantation. Largely, I think, because African agriculture is less productive, and you can get more productivity out of people sometimes by different methods, by letting them work on their own in exchange for a sharecropping relationship where they pay a percentage of their crop. So you get totally different forms, but forms in which the control and exploitation is quite great, and in which you occasionally sometimes have abusive masters.
And of course you've worked quite extensively in both Senegal and Mali on these sorts of issues, and perhaps we could round out the interview by just briefly discussing the advances and perhaps the remaining gaps in the historiography of these two countries.
Let me start with something that's not the question you asked. One of the things that's happened, much of the early research is on slavery is done by expatriates. One of the things that's interesting now is Africans in a number of countries, like Ibrahim Atiub in Senegal, scholars in Nigeria, Cameroon. Mm. Cameroon is a center of very interesting research. In terms of the larger research agenda, there's a tremendous amount of research in Africa which is not published, which lies buried in theses in African universities. Senegal has a tremendously productive history department, and they've broadened out, where they start out in the 60s looking at a limited number of topics. People are now doing every which way, every kind of research on social history, intellectual history.
And in fact, in one of our earlier podcasts, we interviewed Ibrahim Atiub.
Atiub is amazing. Mm. Atiub studies marginal people.
Yes.
He studies people who
prisoners.
Are left out. Mm. He looks at prisoners, he looks at crime and punishment, he looks at drug addiction, alcoholism. He looks at all the people who tend to be left outside of history. Mm. But other people are doing economic history. Other people are doing intellectual history. And the focus on the history of African kingdoms, the focus on political history of the mark of the 60s, has been totally passed in Senegal. That Senegal, and I think this is to some degree true of Nigeria, probably some of the other countries that have very productive universities. Mali, partly I think for climactic reasons, has had less foreign scholarship. Though those of us who study Mali have a passion for the country, and it's part of the Sahel, which extends from Senegal to Ethiopia. Mali is particularly interesting. It's got these old cultures, and
Timbuktu.
It's got some of the best archaeological sites. Mm. You have had is some exceptional archaeological work, stimulated a great deal by the work of the Mackintoshes in the inner delta of the Niger. And so you have old culture, you have a lot of history there, and the agendas are tremendous. Malian historians have fewer resources. It's a poor country, very proud country with a vibrant intelligentsia with limited resources. And there's a lot, there's interesting stuff being done, but it's much less developed than Senegal. The third country I'm involved with is Guinea. And in Guinea, the Sékou Touré dictatorship, and let's not tie, a look at Touré through rose-colored glasses. It was a brutal dictatorship, and it was afraid of the intelligentsia. They wouldn't let. There was an early group that went abroad that included people like the historian Boubacar Barry, who ended up in Dakar, Lansina Kaba, who ended up in the United States. And many of these people didn't come back to Guinea. And so from the mid-60s, there's a period of 15 to 20 years where Guinea does not let its humanists, historians, literary scholars, leave the country. So nobody's doing PhDs abroad. There's also a period when Guinea doesn't let foreign scholars in. When I visited Guinea in 1981, their way of receiving foreign scholars had clearly been influenced by the way the communist bloc would operate. I mean, they were fully prepared to have a delegation of Bulgarian historians come, and then the Bulgarian historians would sit on one side of the room, and the Congolese historian, they would each tell the other what they were doing. And it would be historians one day, oceanographers the next day, microbiologists the third day. And it was revolutionary in 81, though not really in 61, for somebody to come, for an individual scholar to come and work on doing research. And it means that research in Guinea, both by foreign scholars and by Guinean scholars, was set back 20 or 30 years.
So there's a lot of ground to catch up.
Yeah. Now, there were a couple, when I was in Guinea, the archives would close early, and I would often go to what they call the Bibliothèque Nationale, where Guinean scholars couldn't do there was no doctorate given in Guinea. So most of the people teaching at the university had master's degrees. And their memoirs were often were sometimes terrible and sometimes very good. I mean, the best memoir I saw was done by a guy who, as soon as the Touré regime fell, went off to Paris, did a doctorate, is back at the University of Conakry. His name is Ismaël Barry. And he's absolutely first rate. And he was first rate before he got to France. His memoir just stands out. There are good people who survive and who manage to get an education. And there's now a community of scholars the government doesn't give them much help. It's a very corrupt government. But they, at least they're free to do things. And there are people doing interesting things, and there are also foreign scholars coming in. We have very good relations with Guinean scholars. And my hope is that there will be a productivity. All three of these countries, and the Gambia, which sits like a thumb sticking in the middle of them, have interesting they're interesting questions.
Hmm.
The way in which their ecology, questions of the impact of the slave trade, questions of the colonial rule. Bessie Schmidt, an American scholar, has done a magnificent study of the PDG, the Secretary's party, in which she goes beyond, you know, there's a tendency of people writing about modern political parties in the United States as well as in Africa to see the party largely in terms of its leader.
Mm.
But in fact, major developments are often based by changes that are taking place down below.
Exactly, yes. And there's this layered structure and this regional and local diversity that needs to be captured. And
I mean, just as a comparison, you can't write the history of Obama's victory in the last week's American elections without looking at several things. For example, the Democratic Party under Howard Dean after 1904 began trying to develop party organization in states that had been written off in 1904. Well, there were at least three states that were carried by the Democrats where John Kerry had not campaigned before. And the success is partly based on reviving county and local organizations.
Yeah.
And the other thing is you can't understand the Obama victory without understanding the tens of thousands of people, mostly very young, who got pulled into campaign, who were inspired, in this case by Obama. But in Guinea, their counterparts were not inspired by Touré. Touré emerged at a certain point. They were inspired by their hostility to the French. And Guinean nationalism had this radical tendency from very early. And Schmidt has done a brilliant job. And I'm sure Guinean scholars will be influenced by her work.
Right, yeah.
But vice versa.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's this complexity and the nuances that the historian of Africa needs to capture. And you in your own career have, of course, done a wonderful job in doing that. And I think today we've looked at the vibrancy, the complexity, the advances and the remaining areas in these parts of Africa that need further research. So thanks very much, Martin, for talking to Africa Past and Present.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Africa Past and Present is produced by Matrix, the Center for Humane Arts, Letters, and Social Sciences Online at Michigan State University. Our producer is Scott Pennington. Technical assistance is provided by Chris Johnson, Ryan Blyton, and Alicia Scheel. For more information about this show and to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit our website at Afripod, that's AFRIPOD, .AODL.ORG. If you have any comments or suggestions for future shows, please send us a message at africa.podcast@matrix.msu.edu. Thanks for listening.